Thank you, everybody, and welcome to the U.S. Institute of Peace to this event today. My name is Alex Thier, and I am a senior rule of law advisor here at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I also host our Afghanistan working group. And today it is a great pleasure for the Afghanistan Working Group to welcome two of the best known and most interesting commentators on Afghanistan and Pakistan from anywhere in the world. And to have them both on one panel took some doing, but it is really a great pleasure. The border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan has existed outside of the firm control of the incredible mosaic of empires and states that have washed through that region like shifting tides over the last centuries. Indeed, it has often been this area around the Hindu Kush against which the waves of empire have crashed and then receded. And for the last three decades in particular, this region has been the staging ground and the sanctuary for two of the greatest struggles in our time against foreign domination. First, the war against communism and particularly the Soviet incursion into Afghanistan. And it is again the center and sanctuary today for a war of Islamic militancy against Western liberal hegemony in the region. Or at least that's how the people there, I think, would perceive it. And to enlighten us not only on what is happening today, but how we got to this point over the last three decades, we have with us Ahmed Rashid and Steve Cole. Most of them are known to you. Ahmed Rashid has been working in and on Afghanistan and is from Pakistan. So he's been working on the region in some ways his whole life, but has been reporting on Afghanistan for the last three decades. And as he says in his book, Taliban, which I think started out as a small imprint on Yale University, they probably didn't quite expect the millions of copies to be sold that were sold. But this book was a remarkable book, not only because of the moment that it emerged just before September 11th, but also because it provided such an accessible and fascinating account of what had been happening and what gave rise to this movement. And rather than spend a lot of time introducing Ahmed, and as with Steve, I just want to read you briefly a quote or two from the book that are of great relevance. From page 185, the Taliban were born in Pakistani refugee camps, educated in Pakistani madrasas, and learnt their fighting skills from Mujahideen parties based in Pakistan. Their families carried Pakistani identity cards. The Taliban's deep connections to Pakistani state institutions, political parties, Islamic groups, the madrasa network, the drugs mafia, and business and transport groups came at a time when Pakistan's power struggle was unraveling and fragmented. Now, this was not written last week, although perhaps it could have been. It was written almost a decade ago now. Another line, even though there was mounting concern about the Talibanization of Pakistan, the country's leaders ignored the growing internal chaos. Outsiders increasingly saw Pakistan as a failing or failed state like Afghanistan, Sudan, or Somalia. And then going on, even though the repercussions from these wars, Islamic fundamentalism, drugs, weapons, and social breakdown are now aggressively spilling into the country, there is no reappraisal or policy review. Pakistan is now ripe for a Taliban-style Islamic revolution, which would almost certainly jeopardize stability in the Middle East, South, and Central Asia. Again, written almost a decade ago, extremely relevant to what's happening today. Before I go to our speakers, I'll also introduce both of them, and we're actually going to be starting today with Steve Cole. Steve Cole, many of you know, has been one of the most prominent and important foreign correspondents in the United States, spent a long career with the Washington Post, capped in many ways by this fantastic book, Ghost Wars, which won the Pulitzer Prize, I think, in 2004, or thereabouts. This book, to me, was a revelation, and I think to many people, in part for those of us who had spent time in Afghanistan in the 1990s, this was like the book, and he even calls it the secret history. This was the book that answered all of the questions about all the rumors you had heard about who was doing what and why and where they got their funding. And miraculously, although you never expect it to happen, it actually all ended up in one book. And so I'm going to read two brief quotes from this book as well. In the early years of the jihad, the agencies, that's the CIA, station chiefs read British imperial history and managed Afghanistan more or less as Kipling recommended. They raised Pashtun tribes against their Russian adversaries and kept their distance behind the Khyber Pass. Later, between 1988 and 1992, presented with a chance to do the hard neo-imperial work of constructing a post-war national, sustainable Afghan politics, Langley's leaders argued against any direct involvement. Neither the CIA's managers nor any of the American presidents they served, Republican or Democrat, could locate a vision of Afghanistan to justify such an expensive and uncertain project. And I chose that quote not only because of the questions about management, but also the interesting question of whether we are in fact prepared for the tasks that confront us in that region. And the second one, just to complement the quote I read from Ahmed's book, it seemed to Simons, who was the American ambassador to Pakistan at the time, that the Pakistani army felt trapped by the momentum of its own policies in Afghanistan. The Punjabi secularists in their senior ranks viewed the Taliban cynically and worried that they had cooked up a recipe for endless war and that Pakistan was going to be drained and it was going to weaken Pakistan. I think that many of the prescient remarks in these two books, unfortunately, have come to pass in ways that were not even understandable when these two authors were writing them. And so I now open to Steve Cole to talk to us about this era and the issues that confront us today.
Thanks, Alexander. Should I stay here? Would that be the easiest thing for everyone? It's a pleasure to be here, a pleasure to be with Ahmed. We've been colleagues and correspondents for a long while now, and hard to imagine back in the days of the Kabul Hotel and Najibullah's government that this narrative would continue in all the ways that it has. Very difficult to fulfill your mandate in 15 or 20 minutes, but I'll try to tease out some themes, and then perhaps hand it off to Ahmed, who's, I think, been closer to the ground over the last 6 or 7 years, and so I'll probably yield more of the present scene to him and try to talk a little bit about antecedents in the 80s and the 90s with one or two thoughts about today. Of course, as you observed, you could pick up this narrative really almost anywhere if you wanted to. You could start in a British period, or you could even start prior to the Soviet invasion in a useful way. But for our purposes, let's start in the 1980s with the anti-Soviet covert action program and the broad-based Afghan rebellion against Soviet occupation, and try to identify one or two themes from that period that take us forward to the sort of present structures and conundrums. The resistance to Soviet occupation, of course, in Afghanistan was very broadly based, and the political and social leadership that fled into exile or escaped execution or attempted to organize this resistance during the 1980s reflected political orders in Afghanistan that had been stable through much of the mid-20th century. So you had tribal leaders who had served in a Senate. You had religious leaders who led important Sufi and other sorts of religious networks, and you had a natural leadership structure at the beginning of this very messy period of rebellion against the Soviet invasion. But what happened during the 1980s was that this sort of indigenous Afghan political and social leadership was replaced in not a very linear way by the effects of the war and by Pakistani statecraft and by the unintended and sometimes intended consequences of American covert aid to the jihad. And as a result, by the time you get to the end of the 1980s, the leadership of the militias and the most powerful sort of political forces in the insurgency, which had succeeded ultimately in driving Soviet troops away, no longer represented traditional sources of credibility and authority in Afghan politics, but instead expressed international Islamist militias and movements located in some long extant networks and groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, and in many other cases, local sort of offshoots or sort of cousins of the Muslim Brotherhood. And so if you surveyed the leadership of the most important leaders of the anti-Soviet jihad at the end of the 1980s, you'd find some characters who are still fugitives and are still at war in Afghanistan today, for instance, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. Gulbuddin gathered his strength from the Pakistani political parties and state networks that were associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. He had no claim to traditional political leadership in Afghanistan. And his forces represented this theme that I was trying to describe. Even outside of the Pashtun community, most of the resistance was led by such personalities by the end of the 1980s. Now, to some extent, this was a result of a deliberate effort by the Pakistan Army to manage the political aspects of the anti-Soviet war to suit its vision of its interests in a post-war Afghanistan once such a possibility emerged. So the Pakistan Army had leadership at that time, including people like General Aslam Beg, who fantasized that Afghanistan could provide Pakistan with what he called strategic depth against the strategic challenge of an industrializing and much larger India, and that only these Islamist militias could serve as reliable clients. And to some extent, that theme of clients and political control and the unintended consequences of this strategy is a continuous one right through to the present. You know, the Taliban represents a sort of second iteration of this client strategy, in a sense, because after the Soviets withdrew in 1989 and Afghanistan fell into civil war, it turned out that the clients of the Pakistan Army were unable to achieve the objectives that the Army had in mind for them. They were unable to seize power in Kabul. They were unable to prevail over their Tajik rivals. They were unable to organize a persuasive political or military strategy to control meaningful amounts of territory in Afghanistan. Instead, they fell into a grinding civil war with their rivals and started to crack up internally into their own sort of sub-factions. In that context, by the time you get to 1994, this vision of political control or a client government in Kabul looks even further away to Pakistan than it did in 89 and 90. And in circumstances that Ahmed describes so vividly and with such thorough and transparent reporting in his book, the Taliban arise in October-ish of 1994 on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan around Spin Bulduk. You know, I read Ahmed's research as hypothesizing that they were most likely funded in the first weeks or so by trucking mafias as much as anything else, but they certainly arose out of the nexus of forces that you described when you read the quote from his book. And what's sort of interesting about them is less the circumstances in which their seeds sprouted. But what happened as their shoots began to grow in 1995? And as again Ahmed narrates, the Pakistan Army and its intelligence service entered into a sort of an internal debate about who their best clients now might be. And there were some who clung to the clients of the anti-Soviet war, particularly Gulbuddin, and there were others who argued that the Taliban offered a better prospect and a fresh start, particularly because they promised to control southern transport routes in Afghanistan that might offer benefits in terms of trade access to Central Asia and so forth. So by the time you get to early 1996, the Taliban has essentially been selected as the next set of clients for the Pakistan Army's ambitions in Afghanistan, and they're receiving money and support and training and surplus weaponry and officers on the ground and so forth. And it is with this status as allies, as clients, that finally this vision succeeds, in the sense that in September of 1996, the Taliban take Kabul and set up a government that is recognized in the end only by three countries: Pakistan, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia. You know, all along this strategy generated debate inside the Pakistani establishment, inside the army even, about whether it was wise, whether it was achievable, and whether it would ultimately rebound against Pakistan. And what's remarkable is that the warnings about the sort of limits of this strategy and its dangers for Pakistan were issued so continuously over such a long period of time, and yet never prevailed. The argument never fully succeeded. And I think today still is less successful internally within the Pakistan Army and establishment than you might guess. So if you wanted to chart a connection between past and present without reference to such broad themes, you might tell one particular story, and I'll conclude with this. And this involves what's known about the narrative, or at least what's known to me about the narrative of a anti-Soviet Afghan fighter who worked quite along the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan, named Jalaluddin Haqqani. Now, Haqqani was he belongs to an area around Mirim Shah, doesn't he, Ahmed? Essentially is an Afghan. Khost and Mirim Shah. He's essentially an Afghan, but he's an Afghan in the most ambiguous Durand line sense, because his clans and networks really do run on both sides between Khost and Mirim Shah. By the end of the 1980s, he was an important instrument of American hopes for the anti-Soviet jihad among Pashtuns. In fact, he was a direct client of the Central Intelligence Agency, which is not a fact that I reported in Ghost Wars, but is a fact. And he was a client because he was a very fierce fighter with a strong local network. And it was under his protection, we now understand, that the group that we know today as Al-Qaeda was actually born in the summer of 1988 in his territory under his sponsorship. Now, Haqqani was one of the few Afghan militia leaders who was permitted by the government of Saudi Arabia to open fundraising offices in the kingdom. He was a folk hero in Saudi Arabia. He was someone who the United States had a great deal of confidence in. And he and his sons have essentially fought continuously on this same ground from that period in the late 1980s until today. In the mid-1990s, he flew under a Taliban flag and ultimately became a minister in a Taliban government. And after September 11th, he was invited to Islamabad in a very interesting episode in the fall of 2001, where it seems clear that he was offered the chance to change sides once more and to essentially turn against the Taliban, and he refused to do so. Went back essentially underground, gave an interview to Al Jazeera in which he predicted the Taliban would retreat for a little while and then restart their insurgency. He's an old man today, and his sons have essentially taken up the cause that he bequeathed to them, but that area that belongs to his network has essentially been contested and controlled by his networks continuously since about 1985 and today. It's 20 years, and it remains the locus of concern about the potency of Taliban and Al-Qaeda activity directed both at Afghanistan and now pushing down into settled areas of Pakistan. So there is, as you suggested in your opening, just an extraordinary amount of continuity in a lot of this narrative. And we talk about it in terms of political parties and labels and titles and leadership and statecraft, but the narrative written from these districts and from the point of view of these networks between Miriam Shah and Khost would feel quite different from that. There's a lot of labels that are sort of attached to these networks over time, but the networks themselves display a lot more stability and continuity than the changing labels might suggest. So I'll stop there.
It's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you all for coming, and thank you, Alex, who's a very old friend. I have to tell you one anecdote about Steve. Steve and I were working together in Islamabad, I remember, in 1988, on we discovered as to why, you know, the majority of CIA funds that were going through the ISI for the Afghan Mujahideen, about 70% of the funds were ending up in Gulbuddin's hands. And I was writing for a British newspaper, Steve was writing for the Washington Post, and, you know, these stories started appearing. And I remember very well, we met up with Ambassador Bob Oakley, who's here today, and he met us somewhere at a cocktail party, and he shouted across the room, and he said, "Ah, the two most dangerous journalists in Islamabad." And anyway, Steve's story certainly had an impact here, and they certainly upset Gulbuddin very much, as well as they did the ISI. Anyway, listen, let me start by kind of talking about the two fronts in the present war in Afghanistan, which are Pakistan-based fronts, and perhaps going back historically as to how these two fronts have emerged. I want to talk first of all about Quetta. As you know, the Taliban Shura, the Taliban leadership, is based in Quetta today. It has been running the war in Afghanistan for the last 6 years from Quetta. The Quetta remains the major logistics base, recruiting base, training facilities, the coming and going of Arabs and all sorts of other foreigners for the Taliban. Quetta goes back. Quetta, of course, was the base during the 1980s for the royalists. That is, for those who supported the former king, Zahir Shah. And the ISI quickly eliminated the royalists. Most of them were sent into exile. The ISI did not, at that time under Ziaul Haq, did not support any royalist venture in southern Afghanistan. And there was an attempt to insert, in fact, people like Gulbuddin and even Haqqani and Rabbani, who was not Pashtun. There were attempts to insert these kind of jihadi groups into the south in an attempt to wipe out the royalists. But Quetta remained a backwater in the sense that the real war was being fought through Peshawar and Fatah. That's where most of the bulk of the aid was going in, rather than Quetta. And Quetta reemerges, you know, in 1994 as a base for all these madrasa students, Afghans and Pakistani Pashtuns, who were fed up with the civil war in Afghanistan and then, you know, went into Afghanistan, a lot of them from Quetta. Now, what has happened since 9/11 is that I think the first point to make is that the Taliban were never defeated by the American forces, nor was Al-Qaeda. They were routed. A large number were killed, they were routed, they retreated into Pakistan, and they were given sanctuary by the Pakistan army at the same time, even as Musharraf was still on the side of the Americans in the war on terror. Now, Quetta was designated the Taliban center, and Quetta was very quickly, the Taliban were told very decisively that you will not have any foreigners here, you will not have Arabs here, you will not allow any of the Central Asians, the IMU, all the rest of the people who had fled into Fata. Nobody was allowed into Quetta. And the reason was simply to make sure that Quetta would not become a center of American notice. And because of the war in Iraq, in fact, the four southern provinces in Afghanistan were never monitored by the U.S. military in Kabul. And I think this was perhaps the biggest failing of the U.S. military in retrospect, and something that the NATO troops that subsequently went in have criticized very strongly. So from 2001 up to about the end of 2004, there was no monitoring of four southern provinces in Afghanistan, and of course there was no monitoring of what was going on in Quetta. And the U.S. Really, this administration really allowed the consolidation of the Taliban that was taking place in Quetta. And then once the insurgency started in late 2002, 2003, sporadic attacks which have built up to what they are today, a lot of this stuff was coming out of Quetta, and there was absolutely no American interference about that. Now, when NATO decided to expand and was decided to send its forces into southern Afghanistan, the British into Kandahar, the British into Helmand, the Canadians into Kandahar, and the Dutch into Uruzgan, plus a few others, Danish and French and other people, all of these countries came to Washington, and they'd all done their intelligence, and they'd sent out their intelligence teams, and they realized that, you know, half of the Taliban that were operating in southern Afghanistan were all coming out of Pakistan. They were Afghan Pashtuns for the most part, but they were all coming out of madrasas and all coming out of Quetta. And they came to the U.S. administration, they met with Condi Rice, they met with the head of the CIA, and they demanded that the Americans take responsibility for President Musharraf and the ISI and tell them that we are now moving into the south and we expect this whole kind of cross-border stuff to stop. And very markedly, the Americans failed to do anything. And NATO's gripe ever since then, now NATO has, the U.S. has a lot of gripes against NATO, but NATO's gripe against the U.S. is that the U.S. really failed to stop the use of Quetta. And in fact, what we have seen since 2006, certainly when the Taliban nearly took Kandahar, that Quetta has not decreased in importance, it has actually increased in importance. And now with the use of drugs money, with the use of funding from the Gulf states, from the massive mobilization, you know, you have more madrasas in this Pashtun belt in Balochistan now than you ever had before 9/11. And with the advent of more Pakistanis going into Afghanistan on behalf of the Taliban, Quetta has become, if you like, the main base. But once again, the Taliban have retained a kind of sort of virginity about their movement, if you like, in that they have not allowed foreigners to come down into Quetta. So, again, the Americans would not be given the excuse that Al-Qaeda is in Quetta. So I think, you know, now, the use of Quetta was only going to be made possible if there was also a political backing. And that political backing was provided by the 2002 rigged elections, rigged by the military, which gave unprecedented number of seats to the JUI, the Jamiat Ulama Islam. This was the party that had helped launch the Taliban in 2004. This was the party that had continued to support the Taliban. Many of its MPs who were elected in 2002, I knew them very well because they were former Taliban commanders fighting in Afghanistan. And had, in fact, two of them who are MPs today, were MPs until 2 weeks ago, had taken part in some of the worst massacres against the Hazaras in central Afghanistan. And these were war criminals who were now sitting in Pakistani parliament. So the JUI provided, the JUI took control of the government in the NWFP and the government in Balochistan and provided a cover and enormous facilities to the Taliban in order to launch their offensives. You know, madrasas, logistics, they had the authority of the provincial governments. They could get import, export, bring in whatever they liked, etc. So let me, you know, and the second front that opened was Fata. Now, Fata was very different because after Tora Bora, everybody moves into Fata. You get Al-Qaeda, you get the Arabs, you get Central Asians, Chechens, the Chinese. I mean, all the flotsam jetsam that was kind of floating around at the end of the war in Afghanistan arrive in Fata. And here in Fata, apart from a few Al-Qaeda people who were caught, but remember that the majority of Al-Qaeda people who were caught in the urban areas in Pakistan. They were not caught in Fata. For 2 years, until the beginning of 2002 and the summer of 2004, when the first Pakistani offensive takes place in Fata, for 2 years? Two and a half years. They were given complete freedom to live there, and they were facilitated there by the local tribesmen in Fata. Now, Fata is the federal administered tribal areas. It comprises of 7 tribal agencies. 3 million Pashtuns live in Fata, and they live under a law which is completely outside the Pakistani constitution and is not considered even a part of Pakistan. Now, very briefly, if I go into the history of Fata, Fata, of course, was the main conduit for the CIA pipeline into Afghanistan in the 1980s. And the Fata tribesmen became very rich on this. They were the mule drivers and the truck drivers and the road builders. And, of course, all these complexes of caves that we all heard about after 9/11, all this was built across in Fata or across the border just inside Afghanistan in order to house all the vast munitions that the CIA were providing. So Fata becomes this kind of, it becomes this enormous region of deniability. And for the Pakistan military, it was very important to have an area like Fata where you could deny that anything was going on, because we don't actually control Fata. Fata is not part of the Pakistan government. So Fata provides the military with a deniability, especially when the Russians and Soviets were accusing Pakistan of funding. Pakistan would say, well, it's not happening through Pakistani territory. And Fata, of course, is not part of Pakistan. So, I mean, don't ask us what's going on in Fata, because this is a sort of no man's land. And Fata has continued to provide this kind of deniability. In the 1990s, after in 1993, Pakistan was nearly declared a state sponsor of terrorism by the U.S. government because of the training of Kashmiri militants. All the Kashmiri militant camps were shifted from Pakistani Kashmir to Fata. And the training processes took place there, and finally after the Taliban take Kabul, all these Pakistani training camps are shifted into Afghanistan, and Mullah Omar then hands over these camps to Osama bin Laden and Al Qaeda. So you get this very direct linkage then between a lot of these Pakistani groups who were either fighting in Kashmir or fighting with the Taliban. You get them directly linked up with Al Qaeda and bin Laden. And so Fata, continues to play this role, and which is why, despite appeals by the tribal elders of Fata, the Pashtuns in the NWFP, the demand for reform in Fata, political reform, where Fata should be given, Fata should be brought into the mainstream, it should either be made a separate province under the constitution of Pakistan, or it should be perhaps joined up with the NWFP. This remains a constant demand of the people of Fata, but the military has never acquiesced in this, precisely because of the reasons that I posit today. Now, today, Fata, of course, is really, if you like, terrorism central, simply because it has become now the home for groups from all over the world. And almost, as you well know, almost every attack that has been foiled or that has taken place in Europe since 2004, every attack, whether it was Britain, Spain, North Africa, anywhere else, has all been traced back to Fata in some form or shape. And a lot of the terrorism that is coming and taking place in Pakistan today is also coming out of Fata. Now, with the Taliban and all this Al-Qaeda coming to live in Fata, you had these periodic offensives by the Pakistan army after 2004, which have generally been extremely disastrous. And then you had peace deals, which have been brokered directly with the local Taliban, with the Afghan and Pakistani Taliban. You've had Afghan Taliban leaders like Mullah Dadullah and Mullah Ubaidullah, who were sent up from Quetta to negotiate on behalf of Fata with the Pakistan army. So this gives you an idea of the strength. And Haqqani was, of course, living in Fata and was a very important part of that negotiation. Now, these peace deals were simply peace deals that were cut that the Taliban should not attack Pakistani forces inside Fata or inside the NWFP. But there was a kind of blind eye, well, if you want to go across the border and attack American forces, we can't stop you doing that. And this was a deal that, in fact, President Bush last year touted as an enormous victory for President Musharraf and an end to terrorism and all the rest of it when Musharraf came to the White House to launch his book. Now, the other thing that has happened in Fata is, of course, the growth of the Pakistani Taliban. Now, who are the Pakistani Taliban? the Pakistani Taliban are essentially largely the tribes resident in Fatah who did fight for the Taliban, as I said earlier, during the 1990s. They fought against the Northern Alliance. They were not prominent. They were foot soldiers. They were minor commanders. They were sent up by, they were used by the Taliban for some of the dirtiest jobs, you know, massacring, you know, the non-Pashtuns in the north, etc. But when, after Tora Bora, what happens is that these fighters then become the fixers. I mean, in journalistic terms, you know, they become the classic fixers. They're the guys who guide Al-Qaeda and these Afghan Taliban out of Tora Bora, out of, you know, the hands of the Americans and into Fatah. They provide the safe houses, they provide, they go to the bazaar and do the shopping, you know, they go and they provide the language and interpreters and whatever else you need. And because of this very close proximity between these tribesmen and the and they became very rich in the process, obviously, because the Al-Qaeda was paying massively for all this kind of facilitation and fixing that was being done by the by these local tribesmen. And these local tribesmen become very rich. They start creating their own militias. And because of their proximity to, first of all, Al-Qaeda, and secondly, the Afghan Taliban, who are there, people like Gulbuddin and Haqqani and others, they become extremely ideologized. And today I would say the Pakistani Taliban pose, in fact, a greater threat in terms of ideology and proximity to Al-Qaeda than even the Afghan Taliban. The Afghan Taliban, you know, if you look at NATO and what the U.S. military has talked about, I mean, they talk about many levels of who are, you know, 10% may be ideological and global jihadists, but the rest are a kind of lumpen foot soldiers who are there for reasons because their brother was killed or because they're growing drugs or because they're doing something else. The Pakistani Taliban, on the other hand, in my opinion, are far more ideological, and we've seen the kind of terror tactics that they've been using over the last 2 years, first of all, in Fatah itself. What have they done in Fatah? Well, first of all, they've carried out massive ethnic cleansing in at least now 4 of the 7 agencies. That is, eliminating anyone who, any local tribal elders who were against them, killing them or driving them out. So the civil society that has existed, and there is civil society in Fatah, there are teachers and shopkeepers and businessmen and you know, administrators and all the rest, was basically completely driven out. And much of Fatah today is run by the Taliban, basically. And it is this area where they want to create the Sharia state. And this fitted in beautifully with Al-Qaeda, because Al-Qaeda has always, despite the belief in a lot of American circles that Al-Qaeda is kind of now on the web and is now a sort of cyberspace, I've always believed that Al-Qaeda needs territory to operate. It needs what we used to call in the 60s, in sort of the Marxist days of the student movement, they need liberated areas, you know. And the Pakistani Taliban are providing those liberated areas by clearing out all the opposition to Al-Qaeda and by making sure that they a kind of Sharia, a mini Sharia state is created in this region. So you have now, and now of course they're spreading out, they're in Swat, they are trying to conquer other valleys in the Northwest Frontier Province where they can set up bases. Swat, of course, is extremely important because Swat is one of the most highly developed regions in northern Pakistan. It's got a huge infrastructure, it's 80% literacy, it's part of the tourist trade, so you know, half the population speak English, etc. So, you know, conquering Swat and being able to use Swat as a base, even temporarily, at the moment they've been driven out by the Pakistan army, but I think, you know, they could well come back again, and they haven't been driven out in the sense they've gone up to the mountaintops, you know, while the Pakistan army is in the valley. By conquering these valleys, you are really, you know, expanding the use of, you know, giving Al-Qaeda and the Afghan Taliban even more areas to operate. Now, if I can very quickly just turn, what was happening on the other side? In Afghanistan. Well, I think what is happening in Afghanistan initially after 9/11 was that the traditional tribal structure was very quickly reformed. You had millions of Pashtuns coming back from these refugee camps into Afghanistan. You had the end of Mullah Raj, Mullah regime. I mean, the Taliban represented the mullahs. They hated the traditional tribal Pashtun structure. And you had this huge political vacuum, which was very quickly filled by traditional Pashtun tribal society. And this traditional Pashtun society was instrumental and became more powerful in the jirgas that were held in Kabul. You had the first jirga, which endorsed Karzai. You then had the constitutional lawyer jirga. And then you had the presidential elections and the parliamentary elections. And Karzai, he doesn't have a party. He doesn't really have a base. He falls back on these traditional tribal leaders in the south to deliver the vote for him. He tells them to get the women out, for example. They said, no, our women are not going to vote. And he uses this traditional tribal leadership to make sure that the women do vote and come out and vote for him. So in a way, up to 2004 and 2005, in my opinion, Afghan tribal society was being resuscitated. The failure, of course, was the international community and US policy. Because the U.S. was not down there. There was nobody there. There were no troops down there. There was a small American base in Kandahar. There was one PRT in Helmand. And that was it. There was no U.S. presence. There was very little development work because of the security situation. The Pashtuns became extremely disillusioned very fast. And of course, that then provided the ability for the Taliban to come back out of Pakistan into the south and to start propagating that, look, we told you the U.S. would always do nothing. Your lives have not changed. Nothing has particularly happened, etc. And look, anyway, the U.S. has just been killing. It's been using bombing and so many civilians have been killed, etc. And that was the start, if you like, of the raison d'etre for the kind of rebellion in the south. And there are other factors, of course, because the Taliban arrived and said, we will protect your drugs production, we will help you with, all sorts of other things. Now, so Fata then, so you have these two areas which remain very different. And unfortunately, if I can just touch now, I've got 5 minutes, just touch very briefly on U.S. policy. U.S. policy has always focused on Fata. It has ignored Quetta as a separate base. It has declined to analyze the use of Quetta, why Quetta is important. And this was a big problem for Karzai, because Karzai would go to Bush and he would say, look, I'm not threatened by Fata, I'm being threatened by Quetta. Because sitting in Quetta is Mullah Omar and everybody else. Why aren't you dealing with Quetta? And the Bush administration would say, we're not interested in Quetta. Taliban, it's not a threat. The real threat is, international attacks by Al-Qaeda. They can bomb American soil, and they're all sitting in Fata, so we're going after Fata. So you end up in a situation where neither U.S. policy fails completely to deal with the Pakistani regime, to deal with Fata, and you also utterly fail to deal with Quetta. So it's a double whammy as far as policy failure is concerned. Now, very briefly, I just want to touch on a couple of things that is now very prevalent in policy circles. The Americans want to put $750 million into Fata as so-called development aid. The Americans want to spend $350 million arming the Frontier Corps, which is a paramilitary force made up of Pashtun tribesmen. And the Americans also are now talking about arming tribal groups to fight other tribal groups in the Pashtun Belt. Well, first, let me tell you, where is this $750 million in Fata going to go to at the moment? Ethnic cleansing has taken place in Fata. There are no NGOs. There's no civil society. There are no tribal elders. So you can give the money to the Taliban to develop Fata, or you can give it to the Pakistan army, which is incompetent and corrupt and incapable and not trained to do any development work. So, and in all this, the main demand still by the Pashtuns is, we want political reform in Fata. And the U.S. has not pushed for that. The Pakistan army refuses to make any commitment for political reform. It's very interesting that Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif have both called for political reform in Fata. Now, political reform today would be 10 times more difficult than it would have been in 2002, when there was a lot of support for political reform. Now, Fata has been Talibanized. It's going to be very difficult to do political reform. But I think a start has to be made. For example, political parties are not allowed to campaign in Fata. So it would be a good thing in these elections if the army decided to at least carry out the first reform, which would be to allow the secular Pashtun parties to actually go into Fata and campaign. What is happening is that, of course, the mullahs can campaign in Fata because they say, we are not parties, we are just going in as mullahs. So they go in and give the Friday mosque khutbah and say that, vote for us. The secular parties, like the ANP and other parties, can't go in there. So in this part,
And in, you know, in some of the documentation that is public, there is no demands being made on the army by the Americans to carry out political reform in Fatah. Now, for the Frontier Corps. The Frontier Corps is a force of about 80,000 Pashtuns, made up largely of the Pashtuns in northern Pakistan. Now, you know, who are the Frontier Corps? The Frontier Corps were the guys who ran the CIA pipeline for the ISI and the CIA in the 80s. You know, they were part of the Mujahideen. They were told, you know, you go inside, you distribute, you know, the money, the arms, etc., etc., you know. In the late 80s and the early 90s, they were part. They were told to support Gulbuddin Hikmatyar. Gulbuddin Hikmatyar had, at the end, towards the end, he had over 1,000 fighters from the Frontier Corps fighting with him. The Taliban were helped by the Frontier Corps. The last battle of the Taliban, when Massoud lost Talokan in 2000, there were over 500 Frontier Corps, regular Frontier Corps troopers, who were manning the artillery and communications for the Taliban, fighting against Massoud. So what is the Frontier Corps? The Frontier Corps is a jihadi force who for the last 25 years has been told to go in and fight for the jihadis, whether it was, you know, the Muj, whether it was Gulbuddin, whether it was the Taliban. Now the Frontier Corps, as you know, there have been large-scale desertions from the Frontier Corps. The Frontier Corps is totally demoralized. And the American answer is, well, it's a typical American answer. Let's throw a lot of money at the problem, you know, and the problem will go away if we throw a lot of money. But the Frontier Corps is confused because for 25 years the Frontier Corps has been told you have to support jihad. You're a jihadi force, you're supporting the Muj. And by the way, the Frontier Corps also helped train the Kashmiri militants in the 90s. And now the Frontier Corps is being told, no, you're not jihadis. Now you have to go and kill the jihadis. And in fact, you have to kill the very brothers. You're a wazir or a masood, and you have to go and kill the wazirs and masoods because these are now terrorists. Now, you know, the Frontier Corps is not a force. You know, it needs reform. It needs a massive, you know, military-style reform. It needs screening. It needs, who are you giving all this money and weapons to? You know, that's the second thing. The third big sort of answer to all our problems is to arm Pashtun against Pashtun. You know, this was something that Paul Wolfowitz wanted to do back in 2003. He was stopped by Congress at that time, but now it seems to be and the name given by some people at that time was Warlord Wolfowitz, because he wanted to create new Pashtun warlords outside the pale of American forces who would be fighting other Pashtun warlords who were linked to Al-Qaeda. Now that policy is now back in vogue because of what has happened in Iraq. Pashtun society is very different from what has happened in Iraq. If you're going to arm these extra state forces, either in Afghanistan or in Pakistan, it's going to be devastating for Pashtun society. As though there were not already enough splits and divisions and all the rest of it, as though you have not already tried to eliminate warlordism in Afghanistan, and you're trying to create a new Afghan national army and police force, you're trying to create state institutions, etc., something like this will utterly undermine that whole process, frankly. And, you know, creating these forces there would be corruption, there would be drugs running by these forces, there would be state sponsorship of drug running and corruption, and basically the public would be, you know, the Pashtun public would be totally antagonized. So all three options at the moment, the way that this administration is going about, and there is a crisis, I mean, absolutely, but there are answers to this crisis. But I don't think the answer is to throw money blindly at forces who are extremely whose loyalty to the anti-terrorist jihad, if you like, anti-terrorist movement, is enormously in doubt. And even today with this political crisis, I think the biggest gripe of everyone, Afghan and Pakistani, and the middle class in Pakistan, as you know, is out in the streets. Now, the middle class in Pakistan is out in the streets for various reasons related to democracy and constitution and free press. But they're also extremely scared about fundamentalism and extremism, of which the army is doing nothing. And even today, with the so-called, you know, American pressure on Pakistan by the State Department and by the White House, there is no demand at the moment, public demand, to end this sanctuary in Quetta for the Taliban leadership. And Pakistan has still not ended this sanctuary in Quetta. So what is U.S. policy today? Except a shambles, I'm afraid to say. a complete and utter shambles, whether it's related to democracy in Pakistan or whether it's related to fighting the war in Afghanistan. Unless you have a strategic policy that deals both with Afghanistan and Pakistan, that this border is a common border, it's a problem that needs to be resolved jointly, we're not going to go anywhere, and the situation in Pakistan is going to get much, much worse. Thank you.
Sorry. No, that on that high note, we will move to an opportunity for questions. And of course, because we are recording, I'm going to have to ask people to come up to the microphone. So as people come and assemble at the microphone, I'm just going to ask the first question. This story over time reads like a thriller. And one of the great things about a thriller is usually the twist at the end. It seems like when we look at the region that we've been talking about, our attention is usually drawn west to Afghanistan. What effect is what's happening in the Fatah, in the tribal areas and so on, going to have on Afghanistan? And that the target is Afghanistan. And I wonder if the twist at the end of this thriller is that all of this energy now is really directed at a bigger target, Islamabad. And so the question is, in your estimation, do the groups that now control Quetta and the Fatah and are working in those areas, are they more interested in Kabul or Islamabad? Or obviously the answer could be both, but if they're interested in Islamabad, what is the threat to the stability of the Pakistani state that is now presented by these forces? It's to both of you.
I heard an estimate attributed to the commander of the 11th Corps based in and around Peshawar of what the order of battle among the rebels around Swat looked like. And I don't know if this is accurate or accurately attributed, but it was an interesting sketch because it connects exactly to the picture that Ahmed drew so vividly of the demography of the Fatah these days. A few hundred Afghan Taliban operating as sort of volunteers on Pakistani soil. An equal number of Pakistani Taliban who were out of the Fatah and in charge. About 300 Uzbeks, essentially IMU, kind of hard bodies, and some friends of mine who were traveling up there had unpleasant encounters with Uzbek militia on the road in that way that the sort of foreign militia have often had the hardest edge in some of these insurgency environments in the West. And then finally, non-Pashto speaking Jaish and Lashkar sort of exiles or volunteers. So essentially these are Pakistani militant groups that are more Kashmir-oriented, more Punjabi-based, but which have been drawn into this soup because it's the game that's on, or was the game that was on a few weeks ago anyway. So if you take that demography and extrapolate some of the ambition that the Swat episode represents, then you don't see the streets of Islamabad being overwhelmed tomorrow by militia with that makeup, but the potency of it and the Pakistan rootedness of it is striking. And so I don't know what the minutes of the leadership shuras about Kabul versus Islamabad would reflect, but as I say, the sort of Pakistani character of that order battle, if it's at all accurate as a sketch, is pretty worrisome.
Yeah, I'll just take up something that Steve has said. At one level, the excuse given by the government saying, "Oh, this is all up in the tribal areas. This is all Pashtun. You're not going to get the other Pakistani nationalities, the Punjabis, the Sindhis, etc., taking on this kind of fundamentalism and supporting this. So this is a Pashtun problem. We have to isolate them and deal with it as a problem in the Northwest Frontier province." Now, but as Steve's pointing out, I see two major problems that have emerged as a result of the suicide attacks and bombings that have taken place in Pakistan right now. The first is that what is happening in Fatah is that these Pakistani Taliban are very, very closely linked to the Pakistani extremist groups in urban areas.
These urban groups from Punjab, from Karachi, who were very active, if you remember, just after 9/11, and carried out a number of suicide attacks and bombings, etc. Some of them have gone underground, but many of them went into Fatah for refuge, and they spent time in Fatah. Others have gone up there for training. So you have a very close linkage between Pakistani urban groups and Pashtun tribesmen. This is the first time that anything like this has happened. I mean, you've always had your sort of mad mullah rebellion in the tribal areas, you know, against the British, against the Pakistani state, but you've never had this kind of linkage between your kind of mad mullah syndrome in the frontier and Pakistani urban groups, Kashmiri groups who are at a loss as to what to do because, you know, they're not allowed now to go into Indian Kashmir to fight. So this linkage has become, in my opinion, potent and very dangerous. And if you look at, for example, the bombing of the convoy of Benazir Bhutto, 140 people were killed. It was carried out from Waziristan. I think there's no doubt about that. But it was not, you know, you didn't have to send down a Pashtun with a big long beard down to Karachi to carry out the bombing. The bombing was carried out by local people in Karachi. So where did these local people come from? The explosives came from Waziristan, the bombers came from Karachi. They were Makrani, in fact, from the Makran coast. Now, so that linkage is very much there. The second part, if this is, the most potent attacks that have taken place in Pakistan have taken place against the military, against the ISI and against the SSG, that is the Pakistan Army Special Forces. Now, these attacks could not take place without being inside jobs. That is, information, help, support being provided to the militants. So that creates another syndrome, that the Pakistani Taliban, the urban groups, now have people inside the military, probably on a much wider scale than was previously feared. This is immensely dangerous, I think, for stability and security for the army and for Pakistan, etc. What I'm trying to posit here is that the threat is not just a sort of mad mullah threat coming out of Fatah. It's a much more diffuse threat. And then, of course, there are all the linkages with Al-Qaeda. I've been told now, you know, I mean, I remember, you know, before 9/11, it would take up to 3 months for a jihadi from London or Berlin or Paris or an Algerian to be screened and to arrive at a training camp, either in Fatah or in Afghanistan. You know, you came to a madrasa, you first arrived at a mosque, then you were sent to a madrasa, then you finally met up with Abu Zubaydah, or you met up with somebody. You know, it took you 3 months to get there. It now takes 3 weeks. You know, and the case was best illustrated by, I was recently in Germany, as you know, the Germans have caught 11 people who wanted to bomb the U.S. base at Ramstein. A few weeks ago, they've only caught 3 of them. The rest of them are at large, and they're a mixture. There's a Kurdish German, there are Turkish Germans, etc. And what they're saying are, they were all they crossed Iran, they crossed Europe, they came through Iran, entered through Quetta, went straight up. From leaving home in Germany, they were in Fatah, in a training camp in Miranshah in 3 weeks. Now that's extraordinary, you know. If you've got the right connections, it's quite extraordinary. And the second part is that, and amongst them was a white Russian from Siberia, who had trekked down from Siberia, you know, coming through Central Asia, then into Iran and into this route. And thirdly, Al-Qaeda now has German-speaking trainers. Now, what does that tell you? I mean, tomorrow you're going to have Danish-speaking and Belgian-speaking and French-speaking trainers. And so Al-Qaeda is going to set up a language school in Fatah so that they can train all these trainers, so that anyone from any nationality will have no problem getting trained. Because if you don't speak Arabic, you don't speak Pashto, and you don't speak English, you need some kind of language to be able to be trained upon. So, I mean, the risks of what is going on, I think, is very large.
We'll start. If you could please identify yourself at the microphone.
Sure. Thank you. My name is Wahid Fakir, and I'm African American. My own observation tell me that And in Afghanistan, particularly the Pashtuns are angry, and they are angry because they are not represented in the government. And the government is run by a few warlords which are allied with the U.S. And I believe that the Pashtuns are moving away because they are bombed continuously. They are humiliated. And I believe that it is a dangerous process going on in there. And there is a fear that finally the Pashtun nationalists and secular will join the Taliban too, because anyway they see that the America's policy is against them, that is discriminating against them. Why not join the Taliban and being with them, because anyway America is labeling them as a Taliban, as Al-Qaeda. If you can just expand on this, please. Thank you.
Well, there are two or three broadly based surveys of Afghan attitudes that have been returned in the last couple or three months, and they certainly portray a deterioration of attitudes about how things are going and about the government. Although they don't portray anything as complete or decisive as the speaker described or expressed fears about. I do think that what's plain is that the underinvestment of resources in development and security in the South has created a cycle that is working against the Afghan government and its international allies, in which the lack of development and local political engagement is exacerbated by the lack of security and vice versa. And so it spins around. And unless that cycle is broken by a decisive change in investments over the next couple of years, and I don't think it's the next couple of months, but over the next couple of years, then a sort of further deterioration of the attitudes of not just Pashtuns but other Afghans, I think, is on offer.
I think you're wrong on a couple of counts. First of all, you know, the cabinet is now predominantly, all the important ministries of security and money are controlled by Pashtuns. There is no former Northern Alliance warlord now in the cabinet except for Ismail Khan, who is in charge of energy and electricity. And that is one of the big gripes. And I think, you know, perhaps the criticism from sort of, you know, ordinary Afghans is that Karzai has gone too much on that side and has alienated the Northern Alliance. So, you know, I don't think your facts are right on that count. But yes, I thoroughly agree with what, you know, Steve has said, that, I mean, there's alienation, a failure of resources. There's no doubt what you said, that the South has been treated as a war zone rather than as a development zone. There was neglect of the South, as I described to you, you know, by the Americans. Heavily that was due to Iraq and the diversion that Iraq caused. And now, of course, you're in the midst of an insurgency, and now the international community is faced with this dilemma of how do you do development in the midst of an insurgency? And that answer, nobody has been able to come up with an answer for that. Neither the U.S. Army nor the British, none of these big national aid agencies, you know, CEDA, DFID, AID, are able to work down there because of the security issues. Or they're there, but they're all wrapped up in security and in these military camps, and they can't get out to the people. So the real dilemma, I think, now for the international community is who carries out development in the midst of an insurgency, and how do you carry out development in the midst of an insurgency?
Please. My name is Ibrahim Nasser from the Voice of America, Afghanistan Service. My question is directed to Ahmad Rashid. As we know that all the militant groups in Kashmir were imported from Kashmir to the tribal areas by the Pakistani intelligence agencies and the army, and then the Afghan Taliban and the local Taliban, they were given sanctuary in the tribal areas in Quetta, particularly the Taliban leadership from Afghanistan. They have been known to the Pakistani army and intelligence agencies, and they know how to control them. They can find them out, they can arrest them anytime they want. but they won't touch them. They could root out a strong tribal leader like Akbar Bukti in the mountains, who are a local Baloch tribal leader, a secular tribal leader, in a matter of months. But they cannot, or will not, arrest a person like Mullah Omar, who is hiding somewhere in Quetta. So aren't we diverting our attention by calling these people local Taliban, or the Afghan Taliban, or Pashtun Taliban, instead of calling them Pakistani army in civil uniform?
Pakistan army in civilian form? No, I mean, I don't think you can call them Pakistan army. I mean, these are civilians who have become extremists. These are boys who've been through madrasas, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you know, the Pakistan army is not involved in joining their ranks, or actually, you know, it may be turning a blind eye to a lot of their activities, but it's not actually joining their ranks as fighters as such.
Yes, sir. Good morning. My name is John Patson. I was formerly the regional development advisor for USAID based in Kandahar from 04 to 06. So obviously I didn't have the answers either down there. But I wanted to challenge some of the comments about there was neglect down there during that time. I think there was a lot of problems with absorptive capacity there, how you can actually do development in an insurgency environment. However, by 2004, there were a lot of bases there. There were a lot of forward operating bases for the military. There was Kandahar Airfield. There were PRTs in Kandahar, Oruzgan, Helmand, and Zabul as well. So there were people there that were trying to address these issues, but I do agree with your analysis, and that was some of the things that we were trying to struggle with there, both on the political front and on the development front. I have one follow-up question to that, but I was just wondering if you could clarify those comments.
Why don't you ask the question and then they can respond.
The second part of the question was different. I just wanted, for either of the speakers, how much do you feel that either fear of Indian influence or competition with Indian influences in Afghanistan has any bearing on the current dynamics there now, but primarily the first question.
I think the tragedy of USAID has been that it has contracted out all its work. USAID no longer exists as a development agency. It's a check writer. It writes checks. And I've had this argument with Andrew Natsios and with many other people in AID. I think it's a disaster for the American government. I think what the fact that, you know, AID has now been absorbed into the State Department, which gives you completely the wrong impression. AID does not have engineers and agriculturalists and agronomists and all the rest of it in the field. When I grew up in Pakistan, AID had a big name. And, you had Americans, experts in all sorts of fields, who were actually doing projects. Now you have contractors who come, many of them come from very dubious backgrounds. Many of them have absolutely no cultural training or relevance to the country they're in. They're earning huge sums of money. I fear that AID is part of the problem at the moment, not part of the solution. And I think what this administration has done to AID has been devastating. For AID and for the whole concept of American do-goodism around the world and American aid and support and development for poor countries, etc. On India, obviously, India has been the motivating factor for Pakistani strategy, without a doubt. I mean, unfortunately, when Pakistan looks at Afghanistan, it looks through the prism of India and its relations with India. So, for example, the fact that India now has a very large development program in Afghanistan, it has an embassy plus consulates. There's enormous frustration and anger in the Pakistani military that the Indians, I've been told by Pakistani officials that, quote unquote, the Indians have taken over Afghanistan. So, I start laughing. I say, look, there are like 50,000 NATO and American troops there. There are about 50 countries which have more money and troops and presence than India does. How can you say India has taken over Afghanistan? But that is a belief, and that is propagated by the ISI and by these intelligence services. In the media, you're getting all these ISI sort of ideologues saying on TV and in the media saying, there's the Indian presence, the Indians are subverting the Pashtuns, the Indians are even making all the Pashtuns Hindus,
I mean, which is like, you know, I mean, which is quite unbelievable. I mean, you know, and so, you know, it's the kind of brainwashing that is taking place in Pakistan, which of course took place during the Taliban era also. It's very detrimental. Yes, India probably is messing around in Afghanistan, you know, just as Pakistan is messing around in India. I mean, Pakistan is helping fund all the, you know, insurgencies in eastern India and probably with other insurgencies. India is doing exactly the same. It's the tit for tat that's been going on for 50 years.
Thank you.
Just add two things. This view that India is the problem, not only in Afghanistan but in Balochistan, is not just distributed down in the sort of mid-levels of the Pakistani military establishment. It's the view of the leadership of the Pakistani army, and if you, you know, whether in public settings or in private settings, General Musharraf makes a priority of his complaints about Indian consulates in Jalalabad and Kandahar and Tostan. It's, you know, in the order of the universe for these subjects to be as high on the sort of talking point lists as they frequently are is just a signal of how sort of distorted perceptions about what really matters, in, at least in my judgment, in both the west of Pakistan and Balochistan and Afghanistan has really become. And the second thing is that this is not inconsequential for the security situation in Pakistan itself. The army has taken, and ISI have taken advantage of the political environment that they've enjoyed since September 11th to undertake campaigns of detention that are more extensive than at any point, at least since the Zia martial law period. Hundreds of people have disappeared for periods of months, and the fear of being held accountable about some of these detentions certainly influenced the breakdown in relations between the government and the Supreme Court earlier this year. Now, who is it that's being detained? Who are these extraordinary powers being used to suppress? You know, it might be some comfort if they were, Al-Qaeda types or Taliban leadership, though. Even that would be disturbing in the context of the attempt to create a sustainable constitutional order in Pakistan. But in fact, they're mostly Baluchi and Sindhi nationalists who are seen by the army almost as intrinsically expressions of Indian mischief-making on Pakistani soil. So there's this enormous diversion of energy and attention to the wrong problem. And it creates, it exacerbates the patterns that we've been describing earlier when we were referring only to the problem of Islamist militancy. And if you take that in the context of the Baluch insurgency, which, you know, 2005, 2006, and finally the killing of Nawab Bugti, this is all sort of up a piece. Imagine some version of this sort of portrait of Quetta, unmolested, a locus of shura meetings for Taliban groups that are planning violent attacks against NATO forces and, as it happens, elements of the Pakistani establishment. And meanwhile, the sort of power of the Pakistani state, such as it is, the intelligence services and internal security, is all pointed in another direction. And it has quite a lot to do with this prism of seeing not just Afghanistan, but Balochistan and sometimes Sindh through the prism of competition with India.
Yes. Jacob English, U.S. Marine Corps. This question is directed more at Steve, but I'd also like to hear what Ahmed has to say as well, referring to your comments on the Haqqani network. In your opinion, do you think that this traditional power base or his Haqqani's public statements on pursuing just his traditional P2K area and the area just across the border that he's maintained control over in one way or another throughout basically his history, is this an exploitable relationship between him and the Taliban that U.S. military or government or Afghan government can exploit to subjugate that relationship, or is this time passed for that?
Yeah, I think time has passed, although that's what was so interesting about this episode immediately after September 11th, where Haqqani did come all the way into Islamabad, and he allowed himself try to reconstruct this period. I think it was October. He decided to have himself followed by an Al Jazeera journalist and cameraman. So in effect, his negotiations about possibly changing sides or betraying the Taliban would be transparent to his own constituents, as it were. And the comments that he made at that time, which are the principal record available of his attitudes, are really striking in retrospect, because he essentially forecasted Taliban strategy for the next 5 or 6 years. He essentially said, you know, we are routed, we will be routed, but we are not defeated. We will withdraw both in Afghanistan and into the Fatah. We'll bide our time, and we'll rebuild, and then we'll develop a cross-border insurgency. I mean, he essentially said, and he actually put a time frame on it. I don't have the text in front of me, but it was essentially, he said, it'll take 2 or 3 years, and then we'll slowly start to build back from there.
My name is Timur Karimi. I'm a member of Afghan community in this area. According to some analysts, Pakistan has been playing the Islamic card for too long. It has been effective against India, communist regime in Afghanistan throughout the 80s and throughout the 90s. It seems as though it's becoming a liability for the Pakistani government, again, according to analysts. In the absence of the Islamic card, which has been effective in Kashmir and Afghanistan in the past, what is a new strategy for the Pakistani government, for the Pakistani administration or government, assuming if the Pakistani approach against India remains sour, or there's an unfriendly government in Afghanistan? Did I carry my point across?
Yeah, what's the alternative to
exactly
Islamic clients, essentially, if you're the Pakistani government?
The alternative to what?
Having Islamic clients in
combat. Islamic card, the emphasis on the part of Pakistani government in the past have been to focus on Islamization, there's such a term, throughout the 80s, the madrasas, you've talked about that in your book, Taliban, Kashmiris in Kashmir.
You know, after 9/11, when Musharraf did the so-called U-turn, there was massive support, public support for Musharraf at that time. Why? Because Pakistanis hoped and believed that finally the army had woken up. And the army would do precisely what you're saying, that the army would dump these fundos and dump the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and, you know, make peace with India and, you know, that this U-turn would be a strategic U-turn for the whole country, for the army itself, and even for the so-called ideology of jihad, etc., which, you know, the army had been promoting. And that's why there was so much enthusiasm, especially by the same middle class, which is today out in the streets, were out in the streets celebrating what Musharraf had done in 2001, you know, after 9/11. Because they hoped that this would, you know, this is what he said, that this is going to be a strategic U-turn. And then within weeks, we got embroiled, we escalated in Kashmir, the ISI unleashed all these, you know, bombers in Kashmir. We nearly had, for a year, we had a near war situation with India, you know, and then we were started immediately giving sanctuary to all these guys who were coming across the border. So, I mean, there was this enormous hope that we would become a normal state, that we would actually have a normal foreign policy, have, you know, and run the state according to normative means and not have this sort of double-track policy of, you know, being a normal state but also kind of supporting jihad under the counter. I think that's what people hoped for, and I think, unfortunately, that was a huge, it was a missed opportunity, you know.
Well, I mean, you know, of course, Pakistan doesn't have to invent an alternative strategy. Part of its heritage is a secular democratic constitution that has been repeatedly run over by intervention by the army, and that the accumulation of those interventions has created this crisis through the unbroken support of Islamist militias, originally for foreign policy purposes and somewhat sort of instrumentally and even cynically, and now, I'm afraid, you know, in a way that's even more ambiguous as to the final sort of goal of these partnerships. But you know, Pakistan doesn't have to invent its future; it just has to reclaim its identity as a secular democratic constitutional state. And of course there's an alternative future as a neighbor of India. It's one that, you know, many Pakistanis and Indians imagine and parlay about. They're often defeated by their own elites, but South Asia and India and Pakistan both have an enormous opportunity in the next 30 or 40 years to make a great leap ahead in prosperity and middle class formation and in the sort of achievement of constitutional stability. And I would argue, as I do to my Indian and Pakistani friends, that neither of them can get there without the other. That the Indian constitution, while it looks much more stable and much more proven than the Pakistani constitution, is itself has one huge strategic vulnerability, and that is the potential failure of Pakistan. So until this alternative pathway is agreed upon and facilitated through the kind of hard-headed accommodation that would finally hold the army accountable for its support of jihadi militias as an instrument of Pakistani foreign policy, and hold India accountable for Pakistan's success, then this this risk will persist. I'm not especially optimistic about that alternative, but I think it's important to articulate that there is that there is an alternative of that kind, because it's, sometimes it feels like it's receding.
Taha Gaya with the Pakistani American Leadership Center. Ahmed, you mentioned that we're looking for partners for developments, particularly in the Fatah area. And recently, the Pakistani American Leadership Center brought these business leaders in Pakistan over to meet with members of Congress to discuss the reconstruction opportunity zones. And they said they were very enthusiastic about the proposal. Particularly, we had a member who is an industrialist in the Fatah region. And we said, and they met with members of Congress, and members of Congress asked them, well, how are you gonna develop industry in these areas where there is a problem of insurgency, where there's a problem of militancy? And his response was, wherever there's industrial activity, that's where the incidence of militancy is the lowest. And the people who work in these factories, because they realize that the factories are a source of income, are a source of livelihood, they're willing to defend the factories from any kind of militant activity. So I was wondering if you felt that the business community in Pakistan is a good, avenue for development aid to go through and kind of offer jobs in a solid paycheck to Pakistanis rather than the one they might get from other sources that might encourage militancy.
I'm going to take the last two questions and then we'll close up so we can end on time.
Mine links with his. My name's John Rothenberg. I ran a vocational training project in Balochistan for Afghan refugees in the camps during the early 90s. And one of the successes of, according to my former staff, was that many less of the graduates wound up being Taliban as compared to their peers. You were talking about the money for Fatah, and as I understand it, there's a chunk of that's going to go to very similar projects to what I had done in Balochistan for the Afghans. I was wondering, is it you didn't seem to think that any of that money is going to be very successful, and it seemed to me that the direction was a little bit better than previously, and that maybe that some of that will do something successful, and I'd like to hear your opinion on that.
Al Milliken, Washington Independent Writers. How do the various tribes and peoples in the border areas view the nuclear power of Pakistan?
Give you both a couple minutes to respond.
Go ahead.
Look, I'm not opposing American money to Fatah. What I'm saying is that there should be conditionalities for the Pakistan military. And the very first conditionality is that the Americans should insist upon political reform in Fatah. You cannot be throwing money at the prison. If this is a 200-year, it's run according to a British system that is, over 150 years old. Now, you want political reform there. What I'm saying is that you need to nudge and push the military into making political reform in Fatah, which they're extremely reluctant to do because of all this issues that I spoke about and deniability and all this kind of thing. I mean, tomorrow there may be another war with India, and maybe you need Fatah again to train a whole bunch of, you know, guys with who can go in and fight, you know, jihadis, etc. So, I mean, you need to change the political status. I don't think you can get business, investment, security, get the people back, etc., etc., without political reform. And my gripe with all these American proposals is not that they're bad. Certainly the Frontier Corps needs to be retrained and revamped. Certainly Fatah needs money, etc. My gripe is that there have to be very serious commitments made by the Pakistani military to reform the Frontier Corps, to reform Fatah, before this money can be spent. Otherwise it's a complete waste of time. So that is where U.S. policy is completely lacking. And that's where the Bush administration has always fallen down, in having demands and conditionalities which actually point towards political reform. I mean, that has been the tragedy of this $10 billion worth of aid. There's no accountability of it, neither from the American side nor from the Pakistani side. We don't know where all this money has gone that the Pak military have received. And the Americans don't know how this money has been spent even. So, I mean, I think, you know, what is needed is much greater accountability and transparency and conditionality. If you're giving $1 billion, you have the right. You have the right to ask for certain things. You know, you don't give $1 billion as a present.
I would just say, you know, political competition in the Fatah and the introduction of a party organizing and activity there, you know, I don't hear Ahmed arguing that it's a panacea, but it is the only way to introduce secular-minded district-level organizing that can begin to compete with the control that the Taliban have established in the Fatah. And these places used to be, as I think Ahmed described, much more plural than they are today. And until there is a sort of a foothold of Pashtun, locally based, nationally connected political party competition, there really are no alternative channels down which to direct this reform effort. The political agency system has been eviscerated. The Taliban now control it. They are ruthless about their adversaries. And even the secular Pashtun parties that would go in and compete would face a very risky and difficult time, but it must begin, because if the fantasy is that you can have an apolitical reconstruction of the Fatah, it will produce the similar result that the United States got during the late period of the anti-Soviet jihad, when it essentially subcontracted all the politics of the jihad leadership to the Pakistan Army, and sort of consoled itself with the idea that the consequences of uniform Islamist leadership in that movement would be contained and not significant. And we sort of as a government in the United States now know better, but we haven't actually found the strategy or the courage or the will to pressure the Pakistan Army to do it differently. But there really is no alternative in my judgment.
Well, I want to thank our speakers for an enlightening, if not entirely encouraging, discussion today. I want to thank all of you for coming and thank the staff of USIP for working so hard to put this event together, and look forward to seeing you next time.